Our next case for argument this morning is Ryan against the United States. Mr. Olshuler.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. The jury instructions in this case marked four paths to conviction for honest services fraud, and three of them told the jury to convict for conduct that is not criminal.
Mr. Olshuler, I'm puzzled why we are talking about jury instructions in this case. Your brief proceeds as if this were a rerun of the direct appeal, but of course it isn't. It's a collateral attack. And my understanding of the Supreme Court's opinions in Davis and Boozley is that they don't allow challenges to jury instructions, belated challenges to jury instructions. They allow the person in prison to argue that he has been convicted of something the law does not make criminal. In other words, that on the evidence at trial, in light of the later statutory interpretation, the only proper judgment is a judgment of acquittal. But I don't understand you to be arguing that on the evidence at trial, the only proper judgment was a judgment of acquittal. So I wonder what we've got here, if anything.
Well, first, the government has not suggested that these issues are not properly before this Court. I think it's waived any point based on the cases cited by the Court. And second, it is a constitutional Section 2255 affords relief to anyone who is imprisoned in violation of the Constitution or laws of the United States.
Well, Mr. Olshuler, do you disagree with what I've said, I believe, is the holding of Boozley and Davis?
Well, I don't recall the holding of Boozley and Davis. They were not cited by the government, and I...
No, oddly, they haven't been. The argument that you're making is an argument that the Supreme Court rejected 9-0 in United States against Frady, which said that collateral attack absolutely cannot be used to challenge the jury instructions.
Well, we are not simply challenging the jury instructions, Your Honor.
No, you're challenging rulings on evidence, too.
But Mr. Olshuler,
trying to talk over a question from the bench won't do you any good. The arguments you're making look like the kind of arguments that the Supreme Court squarely said in Frady cannot be raised on collateral attack. Now, am I misunderstanding Frady?
I have read Frady once upon a time. My recollection of that case is dim. We are saying that George Ryan was convicted in violation of the Constitution. It is
right. I understand that. That's what the D.C. Circuit held in Frady, and which the Supreme Court reversed.
Now, the Supreme Court has
said that incorrect jury instructions are not themselves a violation of the Constitution. They're a violation of a statute, maybe, but not of the Constitution. And the Supreme Court has said more often than I care to remember that just getting the law wrong does not entitle one to collateral attack.
Again, we are suggesting more than that the district court got the law wrong. The law is that if the jury instructions permitted conviction on the basis of an invalid theory, permitted conviction of somebody who may be innocent, then... that is a constitutional violation.
Okay.
It's a violation of
Your argument, it is inconsistent with both Frady and Engel against Isaac. Now, if you've got an argument that your position is compatible with those cases, I'd love to hear it.
Which I think means, you know, if you are arguing, in fact, that going beyond details like jury instructions, is this a situation where the record simply could not, under any circumstance, support finding that George Ryan has committed the offense that the Supreme Court has now recognized in Skilling? Maybe that's where you need to go.
Right. Well, we certainly do argue that the evidence is insufficient to establish bribery in this case.
What are the alleged bribes? They all relate to transactions with two people, Larry Warner and Harry Klein. The only mail fraud counts that remain standing involve contracts and leases that benefited Warner and Klein. And what were the supposed bribes? Well, Warner, a longtime friend and political associate, was both a lobbyist and an insurance adjuster. And he failed to charge an insurance adjustment fee when Ryan's apartment flooded on Christmas Day. He also held two political fundraisers for Ryan, paid for the band at Ryan's daughter's wedding, gave other benefits to members of Ryan's family, and split some of his lobbying fees with other Ryan associates. While Ryan was Secretary of State, his office entered contracts with three of Warner's lobbying clients and leased two properties in which Warner had interests.
But, you know, there was a lot of evidence at the trial suggesting that this flow of benefits to Ryan and his friends was in return for favorable official action. And I want to put campaign contributions off to one side because a great deal of it had nothing to do with campaign contributions. I don't see why it wasn't entirely permissible for the jury to infer that there was an exchange going on. And I want to use that word as opposed to Latin phrases or other things that tend to get confusing. Well, that there was an exchange. You know, I'll throw this business your way. You'll give me benefits.
The touchstone of bribery is a quid pro quo exchange.
An exchange. Let's just say an exchange.
All right. But an exchange at the time that the benefits are received. Every definition of bribery looks to the moment when the benefits are received, and as of that moment, the official is either guilty or not guilty.
Well, I'm not sure that that's right. I mean, there is this sort of what you could call stream of benefits, or the government called it a meal plan in its argument. And this stream of benefits theory suggests that at the time the benefit is received, it's understood that when the opportunity arises, the other half of the transaction will happen.
We agree that that is sufficient.
Okay. So
if there is an understanding at the moment the benefit is received that George Ryan will provide some unspecified benefit to Larry Warner, that is a bribe.
But can't that be inferred from what happens later? Subsequently the Secretary of State kind of goes out of his way to do things that favor these individuals.
Well,
that
doing
gives rise to
an
interest.
A favor for somebody who's done a favor for you is not bribery. There has to be an agreement of some sort, implicit or explicit, at the time the benefit is received.
Well, that's what Judge Tinder is saying. Why can't the jury infer from the lack of any other plausible explanation that there was such an agreement? Your only answer is, well, they were friends. And that is not, maybe that's a permissible inference, but I don't see why it's a necessary inference.
Well, go back to that hypothetical case we suggested in our brief. The governor has a benefactor named Ben. Ben has given the governor a stream of benefits. He has supported the governor's political campaigns. He's contributed to a private fund to purchase furniture for the governor's mansion. He's entertained the governor and his spouse at Ben's ranch. Until now, Ben has never asked the governor for anything. But now Ben's brother is seeking a government position. And Ben tells the governor that his brother would be a fine appointment. The governor does appoint Ben's brother. The evidence shows no more. Should Ben and the governor be convicted of honest services fraud and sentenced to as much as 20 years in a federal penitentiary? Should this case even reach the jury? A prosecutor might call this the functional equivalent of bribery, and it might have been. Ben might have cultivated the governor's favor with the thought that he'd sometimes want a favor. The governor might have appointed Ben's brother because he wanted to encourage future contributions. One hand might have been washing the other. Yet that characterization toots only one horn of the dilemma. The benefits that Ben gave the governor didn't seem to be bribes when they were given. We want people to contribute to political campaigns. We want them to buy furniture for the governor's mansion. We don't think that public officials can't be entertained by their friends.
But you're assuming the answer to a lot of questions, and I think going back to what Judge Easterbrook was first saying, if the evidence in this record could have permitted a jury to find that there was the kind of agreement that, you know, this is an exchange for that in this case, then I'm not sure how this is an appropriate case for us to do anything but affirm in.
I don't think that's a reasonable inference. In the closing argument, the definition of bribery, as I say, is a quid pro quo exchange. In Evans against the United States, the Supreme Court said the offense is complete at the time when the public official receives a payment in return for his engagement to perform specific official
and
acts.
And the jury could have thought in this case that just such an agreement is in place.
Well, the government didn't even make that argument to
Well,
the
they
jury.
Said they weren't doing the narrow. That's why I would rather us not talk about quid pro quo. They said, though, that, you know, the governor's office was for sale. They said that George Ryan was.
They wanted to imply that there was some reciprocity that was the equivalent of bribery.
Well, let's just say they suggested to the jury that it could infer from the evidence in front of it that there was, in fact, an agreed exchange going on where the temporal moments of fulfilling that agreement might have been a little different, but that there was an agreement.
How did Ryan reciprocate this friendship with Warner, the government asked? Government business is how he did it. $3 million worth of government business. Was it a quid pro quo? You may not want to talk about it, the quid pro quo, but the Supreme Court has in every majority concurring and dissenting opinion in every bribery case. They've used those words. Was it a quid pro quo? No, it wasn't. Have we proved a quid pro quo? No, we haven't. Have we charged a quid pro quo? No, we haven't. We have charged an undisclosed flow of benefits back and forth, and I'm going to get the instructions in a minute, folks, but that's what we have charged. In that and several other statements, the government conceded the absence of the defining element of bribery.
Now, of course, in Skilling, the Supreme Court cites with approval the Whitfield, Ganim, and Kemp cases, which are stream of benefits cases.
And we don't quarrel with the stream of benefits theory at all. It can.
So, in your view,
it can be inferred. It can consist of a stream of benefits.
All right.
But at the time some benefit is received, there has to be an agreement to do something in return. And I don't see any evidence that there was in this case. There are other explanations that are at least equally plausible that are innocent.
But why is that the standard? Isn't the standard as long as a jury could find that there was this kind of exchange? Then we're at least if this isn't a direct
jury could find. That is correct. And a reasonable jury cannot infer guilt when there are more plausible explanations consistent with innocence.
But you're inviting us now to be the jury, and we can't do that. Actually, can't even do that on direct appeal, and we certainly can't on 2255.
I mean, I am astonished that you think I'm asking you to take the place of the jury when the jury in this case did not find bribery, when the jury was instructed on three theories that are of things that are not criminal, and when the government all but disclaimed reliance on a bribery theory in its closing argument. The government now says that when it told the jury that it did not need to find a quid pro quo, it meant that the jury did not have to find an express promise to give a specific benefit for a specific official action.
So let me just ask you, though. I mean, this jury does have, taking the instructions as a whole, an instruction on personal and financial benefits. The record has a lot of evidence about that in it. The jury is told that there's an exchange element to it. So I'm not sure that the jury found in your client's favor, didn't acquit on those counts?
No. It did not acquit on those counts, although there is no reason to believe that it found guilt on that theory.
Well, the district court saw that quite differently. The district court thought that the only reason that they could have come to the conclusions they did was because underneath it all was this kind of impermissible bribe or kickback situation.
Right. That was plainly wrong. The instructions permitted conviction on the undisclosed conflicts theory that the government emphasized from the beginning of trial to the end.
But that's an instructions. I think I don't want to put words in Chief Judge Easterbrook's mouth here, but I think if we are beyond a point merely about the instructions and we're just looking at whether this is a person who is sitting in a federal prison for something that the law does not make criminal, that's Bowsley, that's Davis, that's, you know, Bowsley is the case that comes along after Bailey on the gun point. Then that's a problem. But that, in our post-Bailey and Bowsley cases, we looked at the full record to see if that kind of miscarriage of justice was happening. And if there was even an uncharged possibility that suggested the law had been violated, somebody carried a gun instead of using the gun, we did not give relief.
Well, as I say, the government didn't rely on any of those cases in its brief, and I hope that if the court is thinking about relying on those cases, they will give me a chance to file a supplemental brief and discuss them. I mean, as I think about it, I think Bowsley was a guilty plea case. It applied it was when a guilty plea waived the objections. But as I say, my recollection of those cases is dim. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Certainly, Mr. Altshuler. Ms. Marcel.
May it please the court. I'll begin by just saying that the government didn't make a specific reference at all to the issue that Judge Easterbrook brought up, and we do apologize for that. Obviously, any forfeiture on our part does not bind the court, and if the court does want to have additional briefing on those points, we'll be happy to submit them.
Ms. Marcella, I have a question not only about this subject, which the government seems quite mysteriously to have forfeited, and it's very strange because this is a subject that was important enough to the United States that the Solicitor General took it to the Supreme Court in Frady, and now having the United States having won Frady, the U.S. Attorney in Northern Illinois just ignores it. But I don't understand why we are here at all. I mean, this petition was filed more than 2 years after Ryan's conviction became final and appears to be untimely. But with respect to that issue, it seems that the United States hasn't forfeited. The United States has waived, and I don't get it. The 2255F3 says that the time restarts if the Supreme Court makes a new decision and, quote, if that right has been newly recognized by the Supreme Court and made retroactively applicable to cases on collateral review. What decision of the Supreme Court has made Skilling retroactively applicable to cases on collateral review?
I believe below we did look at that issue, and it was determined that when a statute is now newly interpreted so as to make one interpretation no longer law, that we believe that F3 did allow the 2255.
But that's not what the statute says. The statute says that the decision has to be, quote, made retroactively applicable to cases on collateral review. Now, what you seem to have thought, and I won't press this further because this is something the government, untimeliness is an affirmative defense, which seems to have been waived. What you seem to be thinking here is that if you're confident the Supreme Court will declare it retroactive, then we just don't bother with details like the Supreme Court actually declaring it retroactive. And that's certainly not how this Court has interpreted 2255F3 in the past.
I do apologize for the fact that we misinterpreted that. We thought that that in light of...
Did you misinterpret it, or is this just a Department of Justice-wide position?
No, it isn't. We when we analyzed this below in the district court, we were satisfied that it that he could raise it in light of the new of the Supreme Court's decision in Skilling, and we were obviously mistaken.
Well, the only reason that baffled me, I did some thinking about this as well, is that the only way I could reconstruct your thinking, which didn't appear anywhere, was by thinking of Davis and Bowsley, and that's why I was surprised at the lack of discussion.
In any event, the district court did correctly determine that Skilling does not affect George Ryan's conviction. This was a bribery kickback case, and any error was harmless because a reasonable jury could not have found Ryan guilty.
Why are you back to arguing harmless error? That's the approach that both Engle against Isaac and Frady expressly reject.
And, well, Judge Easterbrook, the fact is, as I think the court has picked up, the facts in this case clearly showed a bribery kickback scheme, a flow of benefits bribery kickback scheme. And the defense's argument regarding our jury arguments on the issue of quid pro quo are just simply incorrect.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, the government went out of its way, understandably, since Skilling hadn't been decided yet, to tell the jury that it didn't have to find a quid pro quo, that it was enough to find undisclosed conflicts, it was enough to do all of these other things, which was a responsible argument at the time. It just doesn't happen to be where you want to be today. And I'm not so sure that the record is so crystal clear. And so I'd like some discussion about what you think the proper standard of review is. One possibility is we just sit around and look at the record and see if we can find anything that would support a jury verdict. Another possibility is we have to say, could a reasonable jury properly instructed with the reasonable doubt standard, et cetera, do this? You know, there's the Brecht standard floating around out there. There's Lanier. There, you know, I think we need to – your view on what the standard is.
Our view is that the Brecht standard should apply here because this is a collateral review. And
you're contradicting Frady again. But go ahead.
Well, it seemed to me that that the finale.
Frady said the right standard, if there is any standard, is cause and prejudice. And Boosley holds that there's no cause in a situation like this. But go ahead.
Well, it seems to me that a higher standard needs to apply, that certainly the Chapman standard of beyond a reasonable doubt should not be applicable at this stage, and that it certainly at a minimum, in order to reverse, the court has to find that there was a substantial and injurious effect on the verdict, and in this record, there just wasn't.
Well, Mr. Ryan's point, as I understand it, is that he may have done quite a few bad things. He may have violated state law in all sorts of ways. He may have violated other laws. But, he argues, as I understand it, what he did not do is violate the honest services branch of the fraud statute. And that's what he was charged with. That's why we have indictments. That's how people structure their defenses. So just because he may have done other evil things in life isn't enough to keep him in prison for something that he didn't violate.
Well, Judge, we believe that the evidence was very strong that he did violate the honest services statute, and he did it in spades, and he did it over a long period of time. And the government didn't say, when it was talking about a quid pro quo, what the government was saying was exactly what the record reflects, which is it was using the term quid pro quo to mean a specific quid pro quo, a one-for-one quid pro quo. The government explained that this was not like a menu where each item has a separate price. It did explain it was a meal plan where you paid an ongoing price and then you got to take what you wanted. That message was brought across, and that was not an original use of the term quid pro quo. That's how the parties were using it throughout this entire trial. So the government was talking about an exchange, and the government told the jury that George Ryan sold his office. They made that argument over and over again.
But how do we know that the jury found that? I mean, there are two possibilities. The jury may have found that there was a pre-existing agreement between Mr. Ryan and Mr. Warner, for example, or Mr. Ryan and Mr. Klein, that, in a sense, Mr. Ryan would be on retainer for them and would shoot benefits their way whenever the chance arose. Or it may have been that they were really just good buddies, and he did that without, you know, any particular payment for it. He just did it.
The defense made that exact argument. The defense told the jury that if they found that George Ryan was giving these benefits these governmental benefits to his friends, and that it was only based on friendship, that they must acquit, or that if the personal benefits that he was receiving were just gifts given out of friendship, then they must acquit. We never challenged that at all. Instead, what we said was that he was selling his office brick by brick. We said in the first 10 minutes of our argument that George Ryan, by handing out these governmental benefits to people and in return getting the personal benefits for himself and his family and his friends, that he was selling his office. You might as well put a for sale sign on it. And in many of the points of our argument, that's the point that we made, and that's what the evidence supported. With regard to Larry Warner, the evidence was very clear, and was so, and both through the testimony of Donald Udston, but also through all the events that happened afterward that corroborated what Donald Udston said. Because what Donald Udston said is that from the very beginning, when he was first elected, what George Ryan did was that Larry Warner decided that he wanted to go into lobbying for the very first time in his entire life. And that he was going to do that so that he could capitalize on his relationship with George Ryan. And the arrangement that Warner told Udston he had worked out with George Ryan is that Udston would be cut in and would get a cut. And it was Udston who was a very close personal friend of George Ryan.
Don't you think most lobbyists do that? It seems to me every time the presidency changes parties in Washington, a new group of people move over to K Street so that they can go over to the Congress because they have personal relationships.
That's fine. But what Larry Warner told Don Udston is that the arrangement would be that he would cut in Udston, who was a close friend of Ryan, not of Warner. He and Warner really did not know each other very well at all, and that he would take care of George. And so that's how it began. And then over the course of the next 5 years, the pattern was apparent. Because George Ryan worked very hard to make sure that Larry Warner got contracts, got leases, that his clients got contracts and leases, and Larry Warner over the years then gave back to George Ryan and did that in the form of financial benefits for Ryan's family and for Ryan's friends. And this was in addition to all the evidence that the jury heard about George Ryan's relationship with Harry Klein and Ron Swanson, because with Harry Klein, that was the guy who was giving George Ryan the free vacations in Jamaica. That relationship only began when he started giving George Ryan the free vacations in Jamaica after George Ryan was elected Secretary of State.
Apparently there's not much of an exchange for that, though. I mean, I guess there's one time when the currency exchange fees go up, which I understand the industry had wanted for a long time, and there's another instance of renting some South Holland property, if I'm remembering correctly.
But these are very lucrative for Harry Klein. And Harry Klein asked for the rate increase while he was giving George Ryan the benefit of the free vacation. That's when he first asked for the rate increase.
But I bet you wouldn't have been making a different argument if he'd waited 6 months after the Jamaica vacation. I mean, $1,000, actually, I have to say, sounds a little cheap to go to Jamaica anyway, but that's...
Well, and one of the things that we were saying that we told the jury is that over the years, George Ryan did sell his office on the cheap. He took all sorts of benefits, whatever size he could get. But more importantly, with regard to Harry Klein, this relationship was an annual thing. Every year he got his free vacation from Harry Klein, and in less than 2 years after the rate increase, George Ryan, just a couple of weeks before he went to Jamaica again for the annual vacation, that's when he told the Secretary of State employees that they had to give Harry Klein a lease. And he made sure that they gave him that.
That's one of the leases he signed personally?
Yes, that is. Yeah. And so when he was then in Jamaica, just a few weeks later, and they were sitting around the picnic bench talking about the South Holland lease, George Ryan had already gotten it in motion. So George Ryan's benefit to Harry Klein was already in progress. They were talking about it. Then George Ryan comes back after collecting his personal benefit, and he made sure that lease not just was signed with Harry Klein, but that the terms of the lease was whatever Harry wanted. I mean, it couldn't have been more clear that George Ryan was there to repay Harry Klein, not to look out for the interests of the citizens of the state of Illinois. And that's the way it was argued to the jury. When the government was talking about that exact episode, what the government said is that when George Ryan went to his underlings and told the underling that he had to do a lease with Harry Klein, and to make sure that the underling told George when the lease was almost done, the way the government argued it says, the government told the jury, he wanted to know when the lease was done so I can tell Harry that I'm reciprocating for his generosity to me from Jamaica. That was the theme of this case. But there was a pattern here. It wasn't just Jamaica. And there was a pattern that whenever George Ryan got a free vacation or his family got a free vacation, he reciprocated and indeed gave a governmental benefit to the benefactor. The jury saw that with regard to the Ron Swanson trip to Cancun. He and Ron Swanson go off to Cancun. As soon as George Ryan gets back, Ron Swanson gets the Lincoln Towers lease. The jury saw that when Ron Swanson paid for one of Ryan's daughters to have a trip to Disney World. As soon as the daughter gets back, now Ron Swanson gets a make-work contract at McPeer.
So I'm going to just summarize and say, to listen to your argument, you're highlighting things in the record that could have supported a properly instructed jury to find honest services fraud, while as Mr. Alshuler is highlighting the aspects of the record that might have persuaded a properly instructed jury that there is no offense here. And that's where I really come right back down to the question that this case turns on the proper standard of review.
Well, we do believe that it is a lower standard from the government's perspective than certainly a direct appeal, because there is an interest in finality of judgments. The evidence was...
Well, both Brecht and Frady say that.
Yes, that is true. and so certainly it has to be more than a reasonable possibility. And in this case, on this record, there was much more than a reasonable possibility that George Ryan was properly found to have sold his office, to have given out government benefits in return for the personal benefits that he obtained from his benefactors. If there are no other questions, then I...
It looks like there are none. Thank you, Ms. Barcella. Anything further, Mr. Alshuler?
Skilling says that constitutional error occurs when a jury is instructed on alternative theories of guilt and returns a verdict that may rest on an invalid theory. I apologize to the court for not having reread Frady in many years, but as I understand the court's interpretation of Frady, it stands for the astonishing proposition that the government could have conceded that there was no bribery in closing argument, and Ryan's and the jury would plainly have convicted on the basis of conduct that is not criminal, and still Ryan would have to remain in a penitentiary. I'm you know, that's an astonishing proposition. If when I look at Frady again,
proposition,
that's what it says.
Mr. Alshuler, it's not the proposition any member of this court has attributed to Frady.
All right. Well, then I don't know what the Frady standard is, but if it is that the jury might have convicted on an invalid theory, then I think we have established that. I think
well,
we could have established that the jury probably convicted on an invalid theory, almost certainly did not find a bribe or kickback in this case in light of the government's concessions in oral argument, in light of its failure even to mention the financial benefits instructions during its closing argument. The government now says that when it told the jury it did not need to find a quid pro quo, it meant that the jury did not have to find an express promise to give a specific benefit for a specific official action. And so when the Supreme Court said that a quid pro quo was needed,
The court didn't mean an express promise for a specific benefit, but when the government's argument spoke of a quid pro quo and said that none was needed, it did mean express promise to give a specific benefit.
So what do you do with the instructions that the jury was given saying don't convict if you think it was just friendship, don't convict if you think it was a gift? The jury did convict.
There is no such instruction, Your Honor. The only instruction that mentions friendship concerns a provision of Illinois law.
There's a good faith instruction.
What?
There's a good faith instruction. If he
there
did these things
in good faith.
There is a good faith
instruction that good faith is inconsistent with an intent to defraud. But the only mention of friendship comes in the context of an Illinois statute that prohibits gifts from lobbyists and other prohibited sources, and it says that it does not prohibit gifts made on the basis of friendship. It doesn't say that failure to disclose a gift made on the basis of friendship can't be the basis for conviction on a conflict of interest theory. It doesn't say that Ryan can't be convicted simply for favoring friends in the award of government benefits. Again, the good faith instruction, the jury could find that Ryan did not act in good faith because he failed to disclose conflicts of interest or because he awarded contracts to his friends. So neither instruction precludes conviction on the basis of friendship. If there are no other questions, I will thank the court for its attention.
Thank you very much, Mr. Altshuler, and we will give both sides an opportunity to reread Frady and a few other cases. We would welcome supplemental memos within 14 days addressing the bearing of four Supreme Court decisions: Davis against the United States, 417 U.S. 333, Engel against Isaac, 456 U.S. 107, United States against Frady, 456 U.S. 152, and Boosley against the United States, 523 U.S. 614. The case will be taken under advisement after the separate memos have been received. Thank you very much.